Dette en podcast fra Dagens Næringsliv.
Hei og hjertelig velkommen til denne podcasten Jeg kan ingenting om vin fra Dagens Næringsliv. I dag må jeg bare si, jeg gleder meg, Merete.
Mm. Det blir stas. Det ikke ofte man besøker. Og til og med fra USA.
Det sier noe om vårt forhold når begge to så glad for besøk. Men du, dette ikke noe hvem som helst.
Nei. Det vinmakeren til Ridge. Det faktisk en av de eldste vingårdene I USA. Ligger på Santa Cruz Mountains. Altså hvis du kjører fra San Francisco, så må du gjennom Silicon Valley.
Ja.
Kjører du opp, opp på sånn 700-800 meter. Der ligger Ridge. Helt utrolig flott plass. Der har de også butikk, faktisk. Hvordan handler vin der?
Men vi kan ta mer, spørre han litt om historien og sånn, for nå kommer det. Welcome, Michael. We're so happy to have you here in our podcast.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
You're the winemaker at Ridge, who has become one of the most, I would say, iconic producers from the United States. We could say so.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Could you give us a brief history of Ridge, the winery that you represent, and why it has become such an iconic producer?
Yeah, brief? Sure. I'll try and contain all of that.
Do you want me to rephrase?
No.
In-depth?
I can start at the beginning, the very beginning.
Yeah.
A gentleman by the name of Osea Peroni discovered a site up in the remote hills, or really mountains, of Santa Cruz County. And if your listeners don't know, and probably don't know, Santa Cruz is the southern peninsula of the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. It's where Silicon Valley is, San Jose. The San Andreas Fault runs through it. And that's actually more significant to Ridge than the cities around it, because the uniqueness of Ridge is its geology. It's this high elevation, fractured limestone soil location in the Santa Cruz Mountains, where the climate is very interesting. It's warm enough to ripen Cabernet, but just barely.
Okay.
Because it's just above the fog line, so the higher altitude mountain fruit can actually get ripe.
Mm-hmm.
And the limestone soils are great for anthocyanins in Cabernet, for retaining natural acidity because there's a lack of potassium in the soil. Very nerdy, I know.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy, Osea Peroni, recognized all that, and this is in 1885. You know, without the benefits of modern science, he just sort of saw this site and says, this is a perfect site for Bordeaux varieties. And he was absolutely right.
Hmm.
So some farming went on there during the late 1800s, early 1900s. Then we had Prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
I always get the years wrong. 22 to 30?
Yeah, something like that.
Anyway, it was a failed experiment, terrible idea. But the California grape growers actually did very well during that period, especially with really hardy varieties. Plantings went up. Vineyard acreage went up during Prohibition because the Volstead Act said that every household in the United States, you know, you can't commercially produce wine anymore or sell it, but you can make 750 liters of home wine.
Oh, wow.
Which is a lot every year. Every year. So there was this huge demand for home winemaking throughout the country. And so everyone was turning to California saying, send us your grapes. So things like Petite Syrah, Zinfandel, Alicante Boucher, could travel far, were in huge demand. So more of that got planted, and certainly any of the older vineyards weren't getting ripped out.
So that's actually the background for the broad variety of grapes that
yes.
you have. Yeah. Interesting. I didn't know.
Yeah. So anyway, Prohibition ends. This vineyard had been pretty well neglected. It was a lot of work working up on that mountain. There'd been some plantings newer than the original. There were some plantings as old as, or there was a recent then as 1949, when the site was discovered by three students from Stanford University. They were looking for a place to take their families on weekends for camping.
Yeah.
Discovered this old neglected vineyard, found its owners, and offered to buy the land from them.
And spontaneously?
I wasn't there.
How goes the story?
The story is it's spontaneous. Yeah.
Yeah,
they discovered in 1959 and snatched up the land right away.
That's a good story.
Yeah, you couldn't do that nowadays in the Bay Area. They made a little wine out of the vines that were growing up there. They didn't know what they were doing.
Okay.
So they crushed it very, you know, very home winemaking style. Left it for the weekend. Couldn't even be there to punch it down or anything, you know, create a little screen to sort of submerge the cap of skins while it fermented. And the wine that resulted of it from it was surprisingly good.
Even though it was kind of left-hand work.
Yes. And maybe because it was so low-tech in their production. Who knows?
Yeah.
So they rebonded that winery and made first vintage of Montebello, which is our now famous Bordeaux blend, in 1962. Mm. Fast forward, 1966, one of the three guys, David Bennion, meets Paul Draper, also involved with Stanford University. He'd done some work in the wine industry in Chile.
Okay.
So he knew his wine, he knew what he was doing.
He was a winemaker?
He was a winemaker, yeah. His original career, and I'm forgetting now, which is probably going to get me fired. I can't remember. But he also did some winemaking had some winemaking experience. He tried their wine, said, "This is pretty good. Imagine if you guys actually knew what you were doing." I'm paraphrasing. And they're like, "Great, help us out." He started helping them out. They actually called him, named him head winemaker in 1969.
Okay.
But, you know, in the interim, he was definitely helping with their winemaking. And that was Paul Draper, who is still involved in the production.
Yeah. I met him first time, I think, in New York at a tasting in 2007, and I visited you.
The 60th anniversary tasting, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, no, that was in 2006.
Yeah.
16.
Probably, but wow, I also went to London last year. He wasn't there, but it was a team from you. We had 20 different vintages of the Montebello, back to 66, I think, was the oldest.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. I don't get to try those wines.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
He became the face of the winery.
He for sure became the face of the winery. I mean, something that he helped with that was critical was, I mean, they had this new bonded winery up in the mountains. They couldn't just make a little bit of wine from the vines that were there. Obviously, they invested into the infrastructure and the farming there. But Paul had the great idea, let's go around all of California, you know, Mendocino County all the way down to Rancho Cucamonga near L.A., and seek out amazing vineyards. You know, there's all these vineyards that certainly survived Prohibition because there was this huge demand for old vines and hardy varietals. Mm. And so they did that. And they over the years, tried making wine from various vineyards throughout the state and slowly over time whittled that down to just a few really premium spots. Mm-hmm. The first one they discovered, by no coincidence, because it was owned by the same folks who sold them the Montebello Ranch, was way up north in Sonoma County, the Geyserville Ranch. Mm-hmm. And we made our first vintage of that in 66.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, which is also the name of a cuvée that you...
Simfonda.
That's right. Yeah, one of our flagships in blends. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Also name of a town up there. And that was 66, and we've made it continuously since then. In 1972, we started making another Zinfandel blend from Lytton Springs.
Yeah.
So that's in Dry Creek Valley. Geyserville's just 2 kilometers away. In Alexander Valley, and those are the two real gems that we found in Sonoma County. A little later on, Pagani Ranch came into the fold. We started making that in 91. Paso Robles, a little further out of town. That's almost Southern California. Mm. And I'd say those are the main little gems that we've consistently been sourcing grapes from since then.
Mm. When you started there, what was your... approach to it? Did you have a mission, or was it just like to sort of
I wanted to turn the whole thing around? No, you guys are doing it all wrong.
Was it something that you thought, okay, I'll we'll see if we can change a little bit on that.
I was a big fan of Ridge for years. I mean, I moved to the area in 2000 and was working in restaurants, and that's where I got my wine bug. Mm-hmm. I did my first harvest in 2003 just as a cellar rat. I didn't study it in school. I went to the most prestigious college for wine in the United States and was an English major. Mm-hmm. Go me, great choice. which is why I was in the food service industry. I was working in restaurants for years. Started working a harvest in 2003 in Healdsburg, where Ridge is. Mm. And they'd finished their facility already in 2001, I want to say. I had friends working there. I had friends who'd interned there. I knew the guy, two people before me who had my current position, and I would go and taste there, and we'd all, you know, get together at these industry parties. It's a very small community for the most part. So I was a big fan of it. And I'd bounced around a few different wineries, not necessarily doing what I wanted to do. And then the position came open at Ridge, and I jumped on it.
But, you know, being a fan doesn't mean that you don't find something to pick on. You know, my girlfriend, when we met, she said, "You're perfect. I love you." And now she's wanting to change me,
really?
You know? So that's how it is.
Hard to imagine. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but she still loves me, I think. But she, yeah.
When I went in there, I'm like, this is decades of success, and they're doing amazing things. And everyone who works here has kind of the same background as me, not really focused on education, just on traditional winemaking and learning through the industry just by working and having a passion for it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to change anything. I wanted to show them that I could help them continue doing what they've been doing for so long. And
I think that's a good strategy also for a partner to think like that.
Yes. Yeah.
So I hope that we can.
Yeah.
Some women could take some learning from this, what you're saying.
Okay.
Your approach here is very, I like it.
Okay, you're not going to like what I have to say next then. There was certainly that honeymoon phase. That first year, I'm like, I'm just here to learn and show you that I can do what you want me to do.
Exactly, yeah.
And then after that year, you know, I have a few ideas for things
is,
that we could.
This is exactly
things
the story
we can
I
change.
Know, you know?
Yes, yeah. Yes. But because I come from a larger organization, a big winery, big factory sort of winery, big industrial style winery. I don't want to say the name. But they did great things, but they were really good at sanitation. And that's where I thought that things could improve a little bit at Ridge. So that was my first contribution.
So sanitation?
Sanitation. Isn't that exciting?
It's very the sexy part of the business.
It'd be the equivalent of a girlfriend telling you she should start flossing. You
know? Yeah.
We still kind of keep things natural. You know, we just rinse things off with water. We don't mind for, you know, living organisms to sort of take over during harvest because we're counting on natural ambient yeast in the air to do all the fermentation because we don't add any cultured yeast, you know. We're counting on natural bacteria to do the secondary fermentation because we don't add cultured bacteria.
Yeah.
So we're a little filthy during harvest, which, you know, is good.
You touched upon it when we started talking of what makes Ridge, but do you think there is something more to mention that that gives the style of the wine?
Well, in that history of Ridge, it's fair to point out that the thing that Paul really promoted was finding these premium sites for amazing fruit and going back to traditional pre-prohibition, pre-industrial winemaking, which is to say, bring the grapes in, pick them just at the right level, not too ripe, not too underripe, just right. Crush them, put them in tank, and let nature do its thing.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from maybe warming the tank up a little bit, and certainly going through and doing pump overs.
So you're warming the tank up a little bit.
Occasionally during early on in harvest, we pick at night. That grapes come in very very cold.
So it's just to start the
fermentation.
Yeah.
Usually that only is necessary the first week or so. You know, when the winery still is, you know, quote unquote clean, because there's not much natural yeast in the air.
No.
Sometimes they need a little coaxing, so a little heating helps with that.
Yeah.
But usually by like week two or three, there's such a strong presence of natural yeast just in the air that getting things kicking off fermenting on their own is no problem, and then they generate their own heat and off to the races.
Mediater is definitely a fan of your Montebello. She's been traveling actually from Monopoly to Monopoly, buying half bottles because that's the only thing available, or was at a certain point. So we have a little a smaller town called Sarpsborg, mm-hmm. which you, I think, not a lot brings her there normally, but she went there a 1.5 hour by car to buy
half bottles.
11 half bottles of rich Montebello.
I say that's a great investment of time.
Yeah, because I wrote about the normal bottle, of course, and people buy them and they're sold out. And then, but then suddenly nobody saw that it also was in half bottle. So there were 11 bottles in Sarpsborg. So I drove to Sarpsborg, bought the bottles, and it's perfect because they are a little bit earlier matured.
I was going to say that, but I didn't want them to. I don't want people to start craving half bottles, and then those will sell out, and you won't have your 11. Yeah, tell no one.
Tell no one.
Do you think they mature in the same way, or would it be a different kind of maturing?
I'd say probably in a different way, but I mean, quicker is pretty nice. Yeah. You know, having a Montebello that is sort of almost like a 15-year-old Montebello that's only 8 years old. That's a treat. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm not sure how you test that. You know.
But is Montebello also your favorite cuvée from what you're making?
Well, that's asking who my favorite child is.
yeah, but you know you have one.
You do. No.
Yeah, I do, but it changes every month. You know, depending on how well they've behaved.
Before we started here, you told me that you listen to comedians podcast in the U.S.
I do.
Yeah. And you know Tom Papa?
I do know Tom Papa, yeah.
Yeah. He is an American comedian to our listeners. He has a very funny bit about that. He says, you love all your kids, you know, and you don't differentiate, but you have that one that, you know, if he disappeared, you would look for him, but maybe not right away. So let's say that you love them all,
right?
But if somebody, you have a, God forbid, you have a earthquake or some fire in your winery then what would you hope the most for not being lost?
Thank you for elaborating on that question and give me time to think about an answer. Because the problem is, and I'm going to keep circling it, because it depends on what you're in the mood for. If you do the child analogy, you know, the one that's the most excited to go to Disneyland is the one you want to take to Disneyland. The one who's ambivalent about it, there's, you know, the one you want to, I don't know.
Okay, so let's say you're on a casual Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have a romantic dinner together.
Okay, there you go.
You have a steak.
Okay.
Steak frites, for example.
Okay. Medium rare?
Medium rare,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
And what would you open?
Litten Springs. Yeah, that's the one. Of our two flagships, Zinfandels, that's a little more structured, kind of broad-shouldered, darker fruit, a little more tannic.
Yeah.
It's also the my baby because it's made at Litten Springs. Our Geyserville, which would be a close second, we still make it Montebello. So it's made at the other facility.
Okay.
So I don't have a hand in that one and therefore care less about it.
Okay.
but there are times where I really prefer Geyserville over Litten Springs, depending.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For chicken?
Maybe Geyserville.
You don't think that's too powerful for a chicken dish?
No. I think there's some elegance to the Geyserville.
Okay.
You know, it's got great acidity, a lot of carignan in it. Yeah. Yeah, especially if there's mushrooms involved. Yeah.
Yeah. And your girlfriend, would she agree with you on this?
She wouldn't care.
She wouldn't care?
She's just like, whatever you want. She's very accommodating and understanding and
sweet. They're still in their honeymoon phase.
No, we're in our 10th year.
But I follow you on Instagram. And I see so many different new bottles showing up lately.
Oh, yeah. There are many.
So there's been an expansion. At least for Norway, you can see
there
are different wines that we never saw here in our market.
We make like 35, 40 different wines, and we only export 8.
Yeah.
A lot of little things here and there. If there's a local grower that is looking, you know, has maybe some old vine Zinfandel, they're like, hey, would you be interested? We'll sometimes say, let's go look at the vineyard. And if we give it the okay, maybe we'll try it for a year or two. And if it really matches our style, we might add it to our portfolio and make just a couple hundred cases here for like our wine club or just...
Because I've seen Grenache Blanc and Pinot Noir.
You might see Grenache Blanc here soon. We're
the Pinot Noir?
No.
Why not?
Oh, boy. We'd done it years ago. We'd done a little Pinot Noir years ago.
Yeah.
You know, we're in Santa Cruz Mountains. We're making Chardonnay. It's not a huge leap to imagine us making Pinot Noir. Mm-hmm. And we made it for a couple of years, and it was good. But it was a little, I don't know if you guys know this phrase, just wasn't really in our wheelhouse. Mm. It was kind of, I think Zinfandel, Cabernet, you know, we're staying in that lane. Mm. Pinot Noir is such a different animal altogether. And there's so many great producers, especially in Sonoma County, that really know what they're doing, have amazing fruit, that we're going to leave it to them.
But can I ask you a question about Pinot Noir? If you have a take on that, I don't know.
I do. It's outside of what we make. It's my favorite.
I think it is a distinct difference between the Burgundy Pinot Noirs, which tend to be a little bit more on the mineral side, and also a more leafy, autumn, earthy style than as the Californian style always seems to have sort of a little sweeter fruit aroma.
Yeah,
you agree?
I'd agree.
And it's not a question of quality. Do you think it would be possible to get the exact aroma profile of Burgundy in California and vice versa?
I don't know about that. I think if we could do that in California, somebody would have at this point.
Yeah.
I don't think so. It's something so specifically perfect about Burgundy for creating wines with that kind of nuance.
What do you think it comes from? Is it the terroir? Is it the yeast or the winemaking style? What do you think it is?
The winemaking style, from what I understand, and this is now getting out of my wheelhouse because I'm more focused on California style production, and I don't have the same, you know, sommelier knowledge that I keep seeing around. That's been so humbling since I've been on this trip. But I think it's definitely more terroir. I don't think it's necessarily winemaking style because stylistically we're doing a lot of the same things. We're taking a lot of our notes from winemaking from French producers like Burgundy, especially with some of our Pinot producers. Where it's very hands off, very much, you know, just sort of terroir driven, and let the fruit express itself. So I think it's really just terroir.
Do you include the yeast in the terroir?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it could be linked to the yeast culture that's in Burgundy.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Something we like to do at Ridge is even though we're very low tech with our winemaking, we're very high tech with our monitoring and trying to learn about what's going on there.
Yeah.
And recently had someone come in and identify what yeast were doing the fermentation at our Lytton Springs facility, and it didn't match anything that they had on catalog. So it sounds like it's a proprietary yeast for Ridge.
Yeah.
And honestly, I see a certain quality from all the wines we make at Ridge, Lytton Springs, across the board, even if the vineyards are you know, far away from one another. So I think there is definitely something about yeast that's lending terroir.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
We don't add any yeast. We just let the ambient yeast do their job. again, we tested ourselves on that. Mm-hmm. 1 year we picked a block of Carignan, put it in two tanks, inoculated one tank with cultured yeast, let the other one go wild, and then blind tasted them against each other, and it was hands down. Mm-hmm. The traditional method wine was far more complex and interesting. The other one was fine and very clean, but didn't have much going on.
I also want to ask you a question about the climate and what's concerning everybody now, the climate changes.
Mm-hmm.
Are you pessimistic on the future of winemaking in California and your sites?
I try to avoid the pessimism. It's hard, but yeah, I'm not too pessimistic. I mean, we're pretty adaptive, so I'm hoping that, you know, going forward, we'll kind of figure out how to deal with climate change with regards to grape growing.
Mm-hmm.
Ridge, we've always been looking decades ahead. We're committing ourselves. We just joined this new organization just last couple of years, and we just gave a presentation about it, and I didn't talk about it because I didn't know much about it.
Mm-hmm.
But we become silver members. This very it's a wine group that's focusing on, you know, battling climate change in the wine industry.
Okay.
So yeah, I'm optimistic. As optimistic as I can be, you know, I've got kids and I want to, you know, imagine a bright future. I had someone a couple of days ago ask me, you know, are we considering planting different varieties in response to climate change? And I thought that was a great question, and I didn't have an answer for that.
That was my next question.
Yeah.
No, like, but what is the answer to it?
Oh, yeah, we're switching to all Spanish varieties. I don't know.
No,
so no. Right now, when we replant blocks, we'll replant to a similar field blend that we've already has existed at our estates already.
Yeah, so you'll continue what you're doing.
Yes,
but is there also an aspect of that the grapes and the plants will adapt to the climate so that they will sort of
right?
Yeah,
yeah. It does seem like that. I mean, I could see. I mean, I can't say that I've witnessed, you know, vineyards adapting to their given climate, but I can imagine that being the case.
Yeah,
you know, these are, granted, I mean, the climate shifted so dramatically in such a short period of time, but these are vineyards that have been thriving in California for centuries. So, yeah.
But I also saw on your Instagram that you had a rosé.
That I'm very proud of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's from Lytton Springs, no?
From Lytton Springs. Yeah. It's from a state fruit. We designated a few small blocks that for whatever reason weren't really performing to the caliber where they would go into our Lytton Springs.
Mm.
So we're like, great, let's pick them early. You know, it'd be Grenache and Mataro. We call it Mataro, Mourvèdre. We even had a little block of newly planted Cunoise, some Sanso, a little bit of Zinfandel.
Mm.
That we picked early, you know, 20 and a half bricks.
Hmm.
Southern Rhone.
Very Southern Rhone style.
Yeah.
Well, John Olney, our head winemaker, sort of cut his teeth at Domaine Tempier, you know, so he...
Mm. Okay.
Ah.
Yeah, he knows his...
In Provence.
In Provence. And so he knows his Mourvèdre, he knows his rosés.
Yeah.
So we do a very Provençal style.
Okay.
Yeah.
And where do you ship it? Outside of...
We only make a few hundred cases.
Oh.
Yeah, we mostly just the staff entirely drinks it ourselves. Yeah,
it's a good stuff.
This is the first year we've actually released it to the public.
Yeah,
and I think it's sold out already.
I guess that's part of what makes it iconic. Also, that is, it's little of it because that's precious. Would you wish that you could make more wine and it could be more available to more people?
Yeah. To a certain degree. I mean, the reason why there's so little is because we focus on single vineyard, and so we are, you know, we are restricted to whatever that vineyard is producing that year.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's a light crop, it's a light quantity.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to push our vineyards for quantity ever. It's always going to be quality. If we do have kind of a big crop, that's when we're out there dropping
mm-hmm.
fruit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's there's a real limit to how much we can produce from single vineyard. We've started exporting our Three Valleys, which is our only non-single vineyard wine.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's something you guys are going to see next year.
Mm.
That's an interesting wine because it's often from our estate. A lot of our estate fruit that we think is really good, but maybe doesn't have the structure or ageability that we want for our flagship wines, but it's still really good. And that'll go into our Three Valleys. And what you end up with is a really complex wine that you could drink young. I mean, you know, most of our Litton Springs, Geyserville, they drink nice upon release, but they're like, you know, try this in 5, 6, 7, 8 years. What do you see? And then the Three Valleys is sort of a mini version of that, but it's not one that we recommend aging more than 5 years. Mm. You know, it's a drink now wine. Mm. So we'll have more of that. That's nice. I like that.
If our listeners are, if any chance in California or in Silicon Valley, for mm-hmm. example, could they drive up to Ridge and to go visit your shop there?
Yes.
Yeah. So they can. It's open for every
7 days a week. Yeah. There's the one down. If you ever fly into San Francisco Airport, you're pretty close to it already.
Yeah.
Okay. It's just a little further south. You'll see. It's 20 mm. minutes switchbacks up the mountain mm-hmm. road. And there's nothing else up there except the winery and everyone who works on it living up there, including mm. Paul Draper. Mm. But it's well worth a visit, especially after the spring releases. Mm. We're at this stage, we're kind of short on wine ourselves until we release the spring releases. Same is true later in the year. In the fall, we have our fall release. Mm.
You have a wine shop there?
We have a tasting room, we call it.
Yeah. But you could also buy your wines there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and whatever we have that's released is there. Mm. So
mm. So there it's usually available, all your...
Yes, you know, everything wines. We make, yeah.
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 Okay, so mm-hmm. we have to go there.
Yes, you do. Yes.
To take a long flight to San Francisco.
No, but you know, that's I guess that's on a lot of people's bucket list to go
sure.
to that area after Sideways, the film. And
yeah, no, absolutely.
It has something to it that really, I'd really love to go there.
Yeah.
You brought some bottles as well.
From your shop.
From our shop. Yeah.
That has not been released in Norway yet.
No, but can we taste it?
Oh, no. I'm sorry. Yes, of course.
So
he's going to bring them back for staff meal.
That was for me. That was my bonus this year.
You tell me a little bit about the wines that we're going to taste.
Yeah, okay. That's our 2021 Estate Chardonnay. Estate Montebello. So this is from the Montebello Estate. So Chardonnay and all the Bordeaux varieties are grown up on the Montebello vineyard in Santa Cruz. Down at Litton Springs, it's pretty much just Zinfandel and its complementary varieties. So yeah, 2021 Chardonnay, grown on the Ridge Estate. We do two Chardonnays, our Montebello Chardonnay, which, like our Montebello, is intended for a little more aging. Mm. This is more drink upon release.
What is the name of the cuvée, the Montebello? It's Montebello Chardonnay.
Montebello Chardonnay, yeah.
And this is Ridge Estate Chardonnay.
Ridge Estate, yeah. But also from the Montebello vineyard.
Mm.
So yeah, plant it up on those limestone soils. You get some of that minerality. This is clearly not an old world Chardonnay, and this is California Chardonnay. Mm. There's some oak treatment. Secondary fermentation, all done in barrel. We do some lees stirring, some batonnage.
But I feel it's more reductive and more acidic than it used to be.
I think so too, yeah. So and I've been getting that note a lot from people, and I'm like, that's great. We've been kind of going for that.
Because it's deliberate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the usage of oak here?
Yeah, so we'll start with new oak on the Chardonnay and then sort of shift after we've deemed what's going to go into the Montebello Chardonnay versus what's going to be part of the estate. And I'm terrible at this because I'm usually focused on current vintage. Mm. But it's usually 45-ish percent new oak, mm-hmm. And then the rest is 1 or 2 year oak.
Do you still use only American?
No, a little bit of French in this too. Yeah. Small percentage.
Mm. Also have some salinity in the finish there.
Yeah.
On the tongue. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and this stylistically, I think we really nailed it in 21. I think we've been doing really well lately, but as far as the oak program goes, you know, where it's just framing the wine, not overpowering the fruit. And
this is available at the Wine Monoplay?
No. It's only if... not many bottles, and it sold out immediately.
Yeah. It has been available for a moment.
Probably just seconds. So it's usually sold out very, very quickly.
It's very nice. It's lovely. Forget it. So let's try the next wine.
Mm-hmm. Our 2020 Montebello. So, yeah. Our first vintage of this was 62.
Not the favorite of your children, but nice though.
Well, you know what? This is my favorite when it's been aged properly. We had a 2010 last night that was starting to really show its potential.
Mm. For how long do you want to age the Montebello?
I mean, it's 2010. It was showing its potential to me. I probably wouldn't go more than 15 years, just because my preference is for younger wines. Mm-hmm. Is it going to fall apart in 30 years? Absolutely not. Mm. I don't know when you start to get that far along, some of the primary fruits is diminished, and you're getting secondary and tertiary.
Yeah.
I prefer more primary. Yep. People who prefer more of that secondary, tertiary, you know, properly aged Bordeaux style would want to go that long. I bought Montebellos from my kids' birth years to open for their 21st birthday. I think that'll be a perfect time to open those. Okay. That was the 09 and the 11. So 20 years easy, 15.
Yeah.
If Paul heard me say that, he'd probably reprimand me.
what does he prefer?
Oh, 20 or 30. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is a 2020 Montebello, a baby, you know, nowhere near the time that it should be opened. But you can sort of see its potential, I think.
Yeah.
We do a really elaborate assemblage process whereby we taste through all our small little separate lots of wine grown in separate tanks around this time of year. In fact, we just finished the most recent 2021 assemblage. 22, excuse me, I keep forgetting what year it is, just a couple weeks ago. And then when we did that, we tasted it against previous vintages to see if we're being consistent, and we have been. So it's an elaborate 4-day process of putting this wine together from all the different pieces that are made up at Montebello.
Are the original three students from Stanford, are they still owning Ridge?
No. No, they're not involved.
No.
Yeah.
Who owns it now?
It is owned by a Japanese company since 1985, actually.
So it's one owner?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, but they're a very silent owner. I think they just wanted to have a very nice California winery. Mm. And
Since 1985?
Since 85, yeah. They've owned Ridge, and we never hear from them. So
never?
A little bit here and there. They certainly get a better allocation than you guys do. So, yeah. So sorry.
They don't have to drive to Salzburg.
No, but to be fair, you guys, this country's number three as far as importance in our market. Yeah, it's UK, Japan, and then Norway.
That's nice for us to hear.
I think that's a good note to finish off on. So, thank you very much, Michael.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
No, it was really a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much. I've been enjoying my stay.
Du har nå hørt en podcast fra Dagens Næringsliv.